This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we learn about sustainable aviation fuel from Atlantic Aviation and how they are making it available at some airports. We also have an interview with Scott's Cheap Flights about getting great savings on airline tickets. Scott is offering a premium membership discount for Airplane Geeks listeners, so be sure to listen for those details. And then we'll finish up with a report about an F-35 shooting down two drones and some comments on the 8th anniversary of the loss of flight MH370. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 695 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. When this publishes, I should be on my first overlanding adventure of 2022 in the off-road trailer that Rob Mark called the Tank when he saw it last year at AirVenture Oshkosh. Like in the last episode, we have a pre-recorded guest interview, actually two of them. Our first guest is Richard Thacker. He's the Director of Strategy and Operations at Atlantic Aviation. Atlantic operates one of the largest FBO networks in the United States, and they are taking steps to make sustainable aviation fuel more widely available. Joining me for the conversation are Rob Mark and Max Trescott. Rob Mark, of course, is contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's publisher at Jetwine.com. Max Trescott is host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Now, this discussion will likely expand your understanding of sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF. It did that for me. Richard Thacker is the Director of Strategy and Operations at Atlantic Aviation. Atlantic operates one of the largest FBO networks in the United States, and they provide a full suite of services to the private aviation sector. Rich has been with Atlantic for more than 30 years. He's been a leading voice in the aviation industry on increasing sustainability through education and outreach. Rich, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're pleased to have you. Now, we asked Rich to come on the show and talk about SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, because Atlantic is very active in that area. Rich, to start it off, the term SAF is coming into common usage. Is SAF really the same thing that we used to call biofuel?
Yes, largely it is. It is a derivative of a biofuel, but the word SAF or the acronym SAF is taken hold as over the last few years. Some people used to call it SAFE, but SAF is now widely adopted use of the term.
And why do you believe that this is the time for SAF? What's happened, or what are the motivations for moving towards SAF that we see right now?
So the right thing to do is to be responsible about our carbon footprints. And, you know, it's not just FBO operators like ourselves. It's, you know, airlines and other sectors of the community. But, you know, the scope 3 emissions from jet engines are a big concern, and sustainable aviation fuel is a direct pathway for defeating that, or at least largely reducing the carbon output that jets produce.
When we think about SAF at an airport, at an FBO, for example, what does it take to establish that fuel type at an operation that's been using other fuels to this point?
So this is the biggest misunderstanding about what sustainable aviation fuel is, because when SAF is produced, it is jet fuel. So there is no need to retool your equipment. There's no need to store it in a different tank or a specialized truck to pump it into an airplane. It is jet fuel.
And so there's really no impact on either the aircraft or the ground facilities.
Nope, not at all. And, you know, some, and listen, you know, there was a lot of misunderstanding about this right out of the gate years back when it was starting to hit mainstream. But by and by, the educational moment has caught up. OEMs are delivering new airplanes with sustainable aviation fuel in the wing. So the aviation community has really caught up on the educational moment here. And understanding that when we take delivery of sustainable aviation fuel, it goes right into the same fuel tank where we're storing our traditional aviation fuel. It is commingled, and it is you know, just utilized just like any other jet fuel product that we have.
Was there a certification process to bring SAF to that point?
Goes through the same ASTM D1655 certification that every other jet fuel gallon does.
You mentioned earlier scope 3 emissions from turbine airplanes. I'm not quite familiar with that. Can you just define that a little bit?
Sure. So scope 1 and 2 emissions are the emissions that we ourselves and our facilities generate. That's from our ground support equipment. That's the electricity that's sold to us to run our facilities, operator lights, and things of that nature. But scope 3 emissions are largely comprised of what they call third-party operators. And in our case, it's going to be customers who operate aircraft.
I got you. Thank you.
When a plane comes up to get fuel, they may not know whether they're getting SAF or regular Jet A, and so it really doesn't matter?
Does not matter. And I'll give you a great example of this. So United Airlines has been one of the leading users of SAF for many, many years. And they have been dumping SAF into the Los Angeles consortium, the fuel consortium there, for many years. We ourselves get fuel from that consortium. And prior to us ever taking delivery of our first molecule of SAF in our own tanks, we unknowingly were pulling SAF out of the consortium at Los Angeles and delivering it right to other operators.
That's amazing. One of the advantages of its ability to commingle with traditional fuel is you don't have to segregate. And so as availability of SAF ramps up, you know, you're not maintaining redundant systems or processes or infrastructure, I'll say, to handle it.
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about the availability. Do we have much capacity these days for SAF, and where are we going with that?
So the availability question is the real question about SAF and why it's not more mainstream today. It's not just the availability, but it's also the cost. And in any free marketplace, when the demand or the supply floods the marketplace, then the cost is going to come down. The supply is very limited, and it's primarily coming over from Singapore or Finland from a company called Neste. And we get the Neste product through our agreement with AvFuel, and that product that we're getting from Neste is going into our Aspen, Colorado location. More on that a little bit later when we talk about some of the logistics on that. But we also have an agreement with a company called World Fuel, who gets the SAF from a company called World Energy. No relation of the companies, despite the similarity in name. But World Energy resides in Paramount, California, which is 17 miles away from our Los Angeles facility. It's a real easy equation to transport the SAF directly from their refinery to our FBO there in Los Angeles. And that's primarily where we take most of our delivery of SAF.
What is the price differential look like these days?
You know, it all depends on the product that you're getting. As I said, some of it is coming from overseas, and so you can imagine it's going to be a little bit more expensive. And I'll go ahead and talk about the Aspen aspect for a minute. So the Aspen community is very important to us, and the ecosystem there is very fragile. So we're doing everything we can to address those concerns. SAF is mostly primarily located on the coastal areas. So how do you get SAF 1,200 miles to the interior of the country? But we wanted to do the right thing for the Aspen community, so we did take delivery and start delivery into Aspen. But we had to be very thoughtful about the process. And yes, the transportation cost is going to increase the cost a little bit, but we ensured that the tanker trucks that were moving the product were utilizing renewable diesel to do so. And renewable diesel is very similar to sustainable aviation fuel with the carbon emission reduction. So by utilizing the renewable diesel, we did not lose or hardly any of the carbon reduction benefit that SAF has by transporting at 1,200 miles. So again, we didn't want the headline to be dirty truck delivers clean fuel.
Right. It's kind of brilliant because – and we've talked about this a little bit on the show in the past, but when you see new technologies or something different that's much lower in emissions, people don't always look at the entire infrastructure, the entire chain, including the manufacturing process and how much energy that takes, the transportation and all of that. So to use that diesel fuel, that's great. That's kind of the way to do it, I think.
It really is. And renewable diesel is another technology that's very exciting. It's primarily, you know, available in California because of the tax credits that the state of California offers. I think you're going to see more of those types of models take hold. I know there's been a lot of petitioning on Capitol Hill for the Biden administration to get involved in that, to, you know, to offer these tax credits to lower these costs. And it's going to also encourage, if those take place, it's going to encourage more refineries to start popping up in interior portions of the country. So SAF and renewable diesel is more readily available to everyone, not just coastal towns.
And do I understand correctly that Atlantic Aviation is also using the renewable diesel for ground equipment at least some locations?
We are. In Los Angeles, we have a very big operation there and utilize a lot of diesel to operate our own equipment, but we also resell some of the diesel to some cargo operators there. And so in April of 2021, we replaced 100% gallon for gallon, all of the diesel that we use there with renewable diesel.
Amazing. That's great.
Yep.
I'm wondering, do you see any, Los Angeles is kind of known as a progressive area. Do you see any resistance politically from perhaps communities that aren't on the sustainability bandwagon, perhaps, in getting them to even look at the idea of sustainable?
No, I haven't encountered that at all. In fact, everyone that I've talked to, no matter what political affiliation they come from, they all seem to want to get behind this, whether it be SAF or renewable diesel. Carbon credits is taking hold and becoming more popular and mainstream. Again, everyone I've talked to in the aviation community is embracing this 100%.
I know that the renewable diesel that you're using on the ground there comes from fats and vegetable oils and waste cooking oils and so on. Is that the same source that's used for the fuel that's going into the airliners, or is it something different?
Yes, it's primarily animal waste fat or tallow and used cooking oils.
And is there enough of that around? I mean, it just seems to me that part of the limitation may be just how do you collect all that stuff and get it to a refinery?
You know, I do believe that that's probably a finite source of feedstock. And I think some refineries have taken notice of this, and they're looking at alternative ways to produce SAF. So it's going to be interesting to see the direction it goes. But for now, it seems like there's enough to produce to meet the market demand. But I think in the future, it's going to be a tough equation to overcome.
Is there a significant educational drive associated with this? I don't know, that either you're involved in or that you're aware of. Do we need to convince operators that they might want to pay a few more pennies for this type of fuel?
Well, the educational moment is can be overcome pretty quickly. In about a 15-minute conversation with any pilot that I've had that have been very skeptical or don't even know the first thing about sustainable aviation fuel, in about 15 minutes, they're fully up to speed. Oh, okay, it's jet fuel. Got it. Understand. And then, of course, when we explain to them that they've probably had sustainable aviation fuel molecules in their airplane from time to time, they really do come to a quick understanding. But beyond that, I mean, it's not a difficult conversation to have with anybody.
What about the avgas side, the 100 low-lead replacements? Certainly a lot of our listeners are flying piston aircraft, and you know, things like 94UL and the G100UL are big topics. Can you tell us anything about what Atlantic might be doing with that?
You know, I wish I had an answer for that. It's just something I – if there is a model out there for – you know, a greener, sustainable aviation fuel for 100 low lead, I don't know about it at this point.
Okay.
So we've kind of hinted at it earlier that Atlantic has, I guess, currently two FBOs that are able to offer SAF.
Correct.
And one is the Aspen.
And the other is Los Angeles.
And Los Angeles. And so how long have they been offering SAF?
So March of 2021 is our first delivery of SAF into Los Angeles. And then we announced our first delivery of SAF on Earth Day of 2021 in Aspen.
How many locations does Atlantic have around the nation?
Currently 78.
So is somebody then from your office kind of in constant contact with the operators at those 78 airports to make sure that they understand the latest about SAF? And is it a kind of a sales pitch to those locations to see if they're interested in SAF, or is it can the corporation kind of push it on them? Or I guess I don't understand how we get it out into all the rest of the FBO locations.
So first and foremost, the primary training comes from my office, and I've communicated with all of our general managers, customer service managers, those on the front line who are going to be taking questions about SAF and having those, direct conversations with the pilot over the counter if they are to inquire about it. At this time, we're only selling retail SAF over-the-counter at Los Angeles and Aspen. There's no molecules present in any of the other locations, but that doesn't mean that you cannot purchase SAF at any location, although we have not gotten to that point yet. But we're in process of going through that process, which is called book and claim. And a book and claim concept is you could be standing at Teterboro, New Jersey at the Atlantic facility and say, I'd like to buy SAF. Understand, we don't have the physical molecules in our tanks, but we can still sell you the green credit for that. That is the concept of book and claim.
So what does that mean, the green credit?
So the green credit is basically the premium amount that you would pay for an SAF gallon. Even though you're not getting the physical molecule, you're buying the fuel that we have received at another location and getting the credit for that SAF gallon. And again, since it's commingled, we're just dumping the SAF into the commingled tanks, and it's just being sold as regular jet fuel, but we retain the green credit aspect of that. A little bit more advanced, but it is a concept that is widely adopted in the community.
And so I'm trying to understand.
Okay, so am I.
Yeah. So
it's an interesting concept. So you're not talking about a Falcon in Chicago picking up a load of SAF, actually not really picking it up, but picking up the green credit, mm-hmm. and then perhaps when they get to LAX, being able to take on the actual fuel. You're just saying they get the advantage of being able to say that they've reduced their carbon footprint somewhat.
Right. The carbon footprint the reduction of the carbon footprint is going to take place somewhere on the planet. It's up to you if you're going to purchase that credit to say that you participated in that process.
And are you passing that credit that they've purchased along through some carbon offsets that you've purchased?
No. So what we do is as the SAF comes in, we keep an inventory. And then when people actually purchase the SAF, we relieve the inventory. When we get to a book and claim scenario, we would just simply do the same thing. I may have lost you guys. I'm sorry.
Tell by that's our the, collective, that's our the collective advantage expressions.
Of video is being able to say, did you get that?
We're absorbing it.
Yeah.
There, none of us are economists, so I think we're missing one little piece somewhere.
Yeah, it's again, you're just paying for the green credit that we hold because we purchased the SAF. You're choosing to participate even though you're not getting the physical molecule.
This is Future Max jumping in. As you no doubt can tell, we were trying to absorb this book and claim concept in real time, and we struggled a little. Well, after subsequent contemplation, I think this might help. Under the book and claim process at a location where SAF is not available, you purchase the per gallon green credit equal to the premium you'd pay for SAF if it were available. In effect, you are paying for SAF to be used elsewhere within the system. But because jet fuel is jet fuel, you don't really care where the SAF is consumed. It's only important that it's being used and you participated in the process by purchasing the green attribute of the SAF that will eventually be utilized at another location while you load traditional Jet A fuel. I hope that helps. Okay, back to past Max. So in terms of expanding to other Atlantic locations, what do you anticipate the rate of that to be?
Again, it's all going to be predicated on available supply and those new refineries that are trying to come online. There's probably about a half a dozen new refineries that are trying to come online in the continental United States, but it doesn't look like they're going to be online until 2024, 25. Again, the two primary producers of SAF, World Energy and Neste, are in process, as I understand, of expanding their refinery capabilities and increasing it. I would say that the available supply of SAF, as opposed to today, to compared to say 2025, is probably going to be roughly 5 to 10-fold. And then, it's going to depend. And as the price comes down of the actual SAF, the transportation costs become a little bit more nominal. And so we might be able to get it into, interior portions of the country. But again, have to be thoughtful about doing that and making sure that renewable diesel is utilized. So again, we're not losing the benefit just to say, well, we've got SAF in Colorado today, or we've got SAF in Kansas City, but we lost the carbon benefit because we didn't use renewable diesel. Wouldn't make any sense.
I mean, you may have touched on this earlier, but in terms of your sources for SAF, are you competing with others for the limited capacity of those producers?
I wouldn't say competing. There's certainly a queue and a line to get in to commit to a number of gallons, and the producers of SAF are committed to partnerships with companies, but I wouldn't say we're competing, and I would certainly hate if anyone was preventing someone else from taking advantage of utilizing this technology. We should all be in this together and maximizing everyone's ability to participate and get this into the marketplace for the benefit of the planet.
Yeah, for sure. I was wondering if there is competition for limited availability driving up the wholesale price, if you will, of the SAF.
I've not seen that, and in fact, I think some of the producers have tried to avoid that to set the price and at least keep it nominal, so it's not driving the price. At least a couple of the producers I've seen have strayed away from that kind of model.
That's good. That's the answer I was hoping to hear. I wasn't sure I was going to hear it, but back to your point that we're all in this together. We've all got good reasons for seeing this expand. So I'm glad we don't have that, that headwind pressure of wholesale prices going up because of the demand. That's encouraging.
Something I was going to ask: turbine pilots typically don't chase price like little airplane pilots do. And I mean, if they want to be at Aspen, they don't they don't go to Rifle to get Jet A for 17 cents a gallon less money. I mean, if that's where the passengers want to go, that's where they go. So I'm just curious if I'm in Chicago, I fly out of Chicago Executive, where you have a location, and nice people at Atlantic. They're very helpful.
Thank you.
We should mention Mike Kurgan. Well, he was the base manager. Now you guys have bumped him upstairs to be a mucky muck where he can be in charge of like five locations or something. But so we never see him anymore. But anyway, I was going to say, if I go into Executive and the retail price for Jet A is, I don't know, let's say it's $4.79 a gallon. How much more will that add to the price if I say, hey, I want to take advantage of that sustainability credit?
Well, first, let me address your comment about Mike Kurgan and the staff at PWK. Thank you for that. They're great people. Mike is like my brother in many ways. But yeah, since we've promoted him a few times, it's hard to get his ego through the door. He's going to gut punch me later for that. But
okay, now we're talking about the same guy. Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. I figured as much. He's going to gut punch me for saying that later. But anyway, so the price of SAF, again, can vary from market to market. But there is definitely a cost of it, and there is a premium price for it. But it's just going to vary from market to market that you're in. So that's about all I can elaborate on the overall cost of it.
Well, I think it's encouraging to hear that we're making progress in this area, and I think it's encouraging that a company like Atlantic Aviation is taking it seriously. Do you have corporate, I'll say, objectives or goals in terms of sustainability?
So we do have a very comprehensive ESG plan in place, and ESG is environmental, social, and corporate governance, and it touches on a number of things. And sustainability is a very large part of that. But beyond what we're doing with SAF, we've done a number of other things prior to SAF and post SAF. One of the first things we did was very simple. Is we changed all of our hangar lights at about 68 locations at the time when we did it to LEDs. That was a big project, and it reduced our overall energy usage by a very large number. And it was very, very comprehensive in its scope and approach. It took about 2 years to complete. But we're seeing it pay off in dividends because it is a very good, sustainable approach for utilizing, lower carbon footprint or reducing our carbon footprint overall. But another thing that we've also done is we're electrifying our ground support equipment. So we're moving away from a lot of gas-powered tugs that move airplanes in and up hangars. We're actually trying out an electric GPU, and in the hopes that that might be something that we can take place. If you've ever been around a busy airport operation, some of these GPUs drone on for 3 or 4 hours, and they're just emitting, gas and emissions in the air for hours on end. They're noisy. We've also taken the lead stride in carbon offsets, and so in Aspen in particular, we bought enough carbon offsets to offset 9.5 million gallons of avgas, Jet A, and our own internal fuel use for the entire, and that is enough for the entire year of 2022. That's our projected gallon amounts in Aspen. And we were very careful about the carbon offsets that we purchased. They came from renewable sources like a wind farm or methane gas mitigation or destruction. And if you know anything about methane gas, it is about 85 times more destructive than carbon dioxide. So, investing in projects like that to mitigate those gases is something that's very important. So, and as far as I know, so every gallon, if you're in Aspen, every gallon that you buy for the calendar year 2022, it's completely offset. And as far as I know, we're the only company, and Aspen is the only airport that's ever been able to offer that and lay claim to that. So we're hoping we're going to set a trend with that and other people follow.
You know, Rich, we've seen examples in the press of criticisms of the emissions from the aviation industry. Sometimes we even see flight shaming from people that are, you know, legitimately concerned about the environment and look at aviation and see it as a source. We know in total it's not – well, there are other industries maybe or other contributors to this issue than aviation. But that still, we want to, you know, do our part in aviation. But do you think there's a need to make just the general public more aware of what the aviation industry is doing in order to become a more sustainable industry?
Yeah, I think by and by we're communicating that to the greater, local communities that we reside in. I mean, if you think about, you know, where FBOs operate, sure, they do operate at large international airports, but they also operate in smaller rural areas where, you know, you've got a smaller presence, but it's just as important. A good example of that is PWK. Another good example is Opa-locka, which is in Miami and is surrounded by residential area. And so the more we can communicate directly to communities, and I'm leaving Aspen out, and I shouldn't, because Aspen is a very important community. I mean, it's surrounded by, you know, very important businesses and also the greater community there. But as we communicate that directly to the airport boards and directors, it filters down to the community. It's picked up by the local papers. That overall message and our efforts are, I think, being broadcast out there.
Very good.
What can you tell us about general trends in the FBO industry? I'm assuming that the last year has been good because business jet travel seems to be up substantially. But what kind of trends are you just seeing overall in the FBO industry?
So make no mistake, I mean, COVID has chased a lot of the general flying public to the private sector. And so we have seen some growth in that. Whether or not that's, I guess, pun intended, sustainable, will be, you know, seen. I think more people as the COVID, and I know COVID is starting to, you know, hopefully, you know, go away for good. Right. But I think there was there's a bit of a fear factor with some of the flying public. And some people are just saying, I'm never going to climb on a commercial airliner again. And they either somehow find the money to fly privately or they, you know, figure out a way to, you know, travel by other means. But we've certainly seen a bit of a growth factor in that.
All right. Very good. People can learn more about Atlantic Aviation, obviously at atlanticaviation.com. Rich, are there any other resources or sites or things online where people who are interested in this topic might go and look?
So, there's a number of resources. If you want to learn more about sustainable aviation fuel specifically, I would encourage you to look up World Energy or Neste. They both are the leading innovators in it. And there's lots of information on their websites and associated pages that you'll find in those links. And if you have any questions, anybody has any questions, they're always welcome to call me directly. I've been an operator in the field for over 29 years, and there's a reason why my cell phone is kept on 24 hours a day. So I am available at all.
Who are you?
Yeah, right.
Excellent. I'm going to forward my calls to your number.
Perfect.
See what you started, Rich?
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
Thank you for joining us. So we really appreciate the opportunity to have someone come on the show and talk about this really important topic broadly, but also specifically about what Atlantic Aviation is doing and the role that you're playing in this whole space. So again, thanks a lot for joining us. We look forward to following along the progress that Atlantic Aviation makes and others as well. if we have some breaking news and or developments or something in the future, you know how to reach us. Maybe we can get you on again and get an update when that's appropriate. So thank you very much.
I'd love to do it, and I thank you guys for the opportunity today. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Rich.
My pleasure.
In our conversation, we talked a little about Scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. In the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/695, you'll find a link to an easy-to-read source that describes this in some detail. It's a 2021 article from sustain.life called "What Are Scope 1, 2, and 3 Emissions?" It's worth looking at. Brian Coleman interviewed Scott from Scott's Cheap Flights, which notifies users of great airline deals. We learn how a hobby turned into a business, and Scott provides some good context for the current state of airline fares. Here we go.
Scott, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
In 2013, if I have this right, you founded Scott's Cheap Flights, which really notifies users of great airline deals. Did I get that about right?
You did, though. Even at the time in 2013, when I founded Scott's Cheap Flights, I didn't actually know that I was founding this company. And the reason why I didn't know it was a hobby. It was something I was doing for my friends. And just over time, they told their friends, people found out and signed up. And eventually by 2015, it got large enough where it's time to think about it, not as so much as a hobby. Is there an actual business? Is there a startup here?
So you did not get the idea or inspiration from Best Fares magazine?
No, it was a very serendipitous founding for how Scott's Cheap Flights began. I was that prototypical college graduate, really wanted to travel, but had almost no money in the bank account. I knew people were somehow getting cheap flights out there, but I had no idea how they were doing it. I was working at the time as a journalist and really kind of put on my journalist hat to try to figure out why is airfare so volatile? How do you put yourself in a position to get good flights? And by 2013, I'd gotten good enough that I was able to then find, still to this day, probably the single best deal that I've ever personally gotten in my life, which was nonstop from New York City to Milan for $130 round trip.
Wow.
I was aghast at that fare. I couldn't believe it. It was, nonstop flight on United, check bags, all the works. But when I got back from this trip, all my friends and coworkers kept coming up to me. Hey, Scott, I heard about that great deal you got. Listen, next time you find a deal like that, can you let me know so I can get in on it too? And so rather than trying to remember everybody I was supposed to let know, I decided, why don't I start a simple little email list? I can let everybody know at once. In that moment, Scott's Cheap Flights was born. But again, it was a hobby for the next 2 years or so until 2015 when I actually started it as a company.
And then the way that you make money on this is there's a free service and then you actually sell a premium subscription service, correct?
That's exactly right. So we don't get any kickbacks from the airlines. We don't get any kickbacks when you book a flight. Our funding comes entirely from members who pay that if they opt to pay for that premium service where you're getting more deals from your home airport. You're getting certain better types of deals, peak season deals, mistake fares like that $130 flight to Milan, those types of things. But we have that free tier. So folks can kind of kick the tires, try it out for themselves for a little while, see if they find value in it. And if they want, they can upgrade.
That sounds great. Now, I have a personal question here for you, because of course, I'm doing my project, The Journey is the Reward, and I'm working towards getting my 3 million actual paid lifetime miles with United, which will get me 1K status for the rest of my life, which is kind of a cool deal. How can Scott's Cheap Flights help out with a really specific requirement that I have? Whereas in order to do this, I need to fly on United aircraft, so United metal. Do you have an option where people can choose either their origin airport or a carrier of choice?
The origin airport, absolutely. So the way it sets up is that you can choose not only your home airport where you're getting deals from, but you can actually choose a number of different airports. So let's say you live in the New York City region, maybe Newark is your home airport for United, but you might also want to be keeping an eye on cheap flights out of Philadelphia, out of Boston, out of Hartford, even out of Washington, D.C., because, when I got that great deal, for instance, from Newark to Milan for $130 round trip, I was actually living in Washington, D.C. at the time, but it was worth it to me to pay that 20 $20 bus fare to get up to New York for that deal, rather than having to pay the $600-$800 it would have cost to fly out of DC. So when you sign up for Scottsdale Flights, you get to tell us which airport you want to fly out of and which types of deals do you want. Are you interested mostly in economy or interested in business class, that type of thing? And we'll be able to tell you which part of the list, which segment of service is going to be best suited for you. We don't currently kind of filter things by airline per se, but we do one of the things by value of not getting affiliate fees or not getting kickbacks from airlines is we like to be very upfront with our members about what this deal means to them. And so it's not hiding bag fees. It's not hiding what the airline is or when the dates are, because our only source of support is from our members. So we want to make sure that we're giving that information as clearly and transparently as possible. And so every deal is going to say what airline this is a part of or what partner airlines it can be booked on, when the dates are available, and hopefully then be able to take some of those ones, especially those mileage earning fares and those premium economy business class flights that are going to get you to that 1K lifetime status even quicker.
Many of our listeners aren't here in the U.S. Do you have an international base as well? Can our international listeners partake in Scott's Cheap Flights?
So right now, Scott's Cheap Flights just services flights that are departing the U.S., you know, round trip flight obviously included. What we do is that for folks, we're always exploring, you know, is there interest in Scott's Cheap Flights outside the U.S.? And so if you go to scottscheapflights.com as an international visitor, you'll actually be directed towards a wait list. This will help inform us, hey, where are there a lot of folks who might be interested? You know, maybe it's in Canada, maybe it's in the UK, maybe it's in Australia, where we see a lot of demand for this. And that kind of helps us try to triage and inform where should we be thinking about next. So, you know, not great news for today, but for tomorrow, hoping for better news.
And what about small airports? It seems like many of the deals happen out of the larger hub airports. You know, I'm here in Los Angeles at LAX. We talked about Newark, JFK. Seems like there are a lot of deals out of there. But, well, for example, our main man, Micah, he lives in Portland, Maine. And yeah, he was saying, as I was prepping for this interview with you, he was saying that he'd love to join, but just didn't see the value because flying out of Portland, Maine, there just weren't any deals. So how are you supporting the smaller secondary, tertiary airports?
Absolutely. Look, I love this question because first off, we support over 180 airports around the U.S. It's not just New York, L.A., and Chicago. It's over 180 different ones, as large as JFK, as small as Cody, Wyoming. Secondly, while it's true that Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, they get the highest quantity of deals, I would actually argue that small airports that we support get the highest quality of deals. Now, here's why. A typical flight from New York to Paris is going to cost maybe $800 round trip. And so when that drops down to, let's say, $400 round trip, you're saving $400. That's great. But a typical flight from Portland, Maine to Paris might actually cost closer to $1,200. And so when that drops down to $400, you're saving $800 off of that flight. The only way to save $800 off of a typical flight from New York to Paris is if the airline gives you that ticket for free.
Exactly.
I don't think they're going to be doing that anytime soon. And even just, you know, in the past week, we found flights I just pulled up from Portland, Maine to Venice in Italy for $489 round trip, Portland, Maine to Paris for $487, Portland, Maine to Morocco for $459 round trip, over to Scotland for $421 round trip. So while it's true that the biggest quantity of deals goes to the large cities, there are still a lot to choose from, even from smaller airports like Portland, Maine, or like my home airport growing up of Dayton, Ohio.
And I'm actually closest to Burbank. So if you have any deals out of Burbank, that would certainly be appealing to me. So I don't have to deal with LA traffic and drive all the way to LAX.
One of the fastest growing LA airports. I mean, a lot of the budget airlines are really kind of honing in on Burbank as their new hub, both, and especially some of the new Canadian budget airlines that are going to be flying a lot in and out of Burbank.
Very cool. So speaking of deals, over the past 12 months, what are some of the best deals that you've seen?
Gosh, it's hard to even think over the past 12 months because I could just be citing them from the past 12 days. I mean, gosh, just in the past week, This morning, we found, you know, we're recording on February 17th, we found flights from all over the U.S., Tampa, Chicago, Boston, D.C., L.A., San Jose, over to London in the summertime, nonstop for $498 round trip. And
wow.
And as I'm sure you're well aware, summer flights are incredibly difficult to find cheap. Yep. It is summer flights to Europe. You almost never see under $800, $900. So to see that nonstop under $500 round trip from so many airports, it was a real steal. Didn't go into Azores, where there have been flights, including summer availability to the Azores, you know, those beautiful, majestic Portuguese islands in the Atlantic, including summer fares from not only from Boston in New York and Chicago, but from like Allentown, Pennsylvania, from Albuquerque, New Mexico, from Birmingham, Alabama, under $450 round trips. Those have been a couple of my favorites. I'm always, though, personally on the lookout for great deals to Japan. No, it's one of the perennial favorites. My single favorite deal probably for the past 12 months was when the entire U.S. was on sale to Japan just about 10 months ago or so for $202 round trip. I could not believe that fare. It was totally unexpected. Nothing could have prepared us to know that this was going to happen. And when those great deals happen, like $202 round trip to Japan, they tend to last a matter of hours, not days. And so that's why Scott's Cheap Flights exist, so that folks can find out about those deals before they disappear. If you didn't just happen to be searching for flights to Japan in that narrow window when they were available, you would have missed out on the deal of the year. And so that's why we kind of spend all day, every day looking for these flights so that our members are able to book them before they disappear.
I guess this wouldn't be an interview without mentioning COVID right now. And I think probably part of the reason why the airfares were so incredibly cheap to Japan is because you had to quarantine once you got there. But with COVID, what sort of things have you seen? How has it affected not so much your business, but airfare pricing in general? Anything beyond these spectacular Japan fares?
Yeah. So, well, the good thing about those Japan fares is they were actually available for the next year. And so there are still folks who are sitting on those, hoping that maybe they'll be able to use them later in 2022. Fingers crossed that those borders open. If not, I doubt many people are going to be willing to undergo a quarantine just to take a vacation. You'll be able to either change your dates or just get a refund or a travel credit.
Yeah.
In terms of impact that we've seen on airfare from the pandemic, the single biggest thing that comes to mind, airlines have shifted their route networks to fly towards more leisure destinations. Certainly, you see just more volume to places like Hawaii and Cancun and Florida. But the single biggest change has actually been a big increase in the availability of last-minute cheap flights. You know, last-minute cheap flights is frankly something of an oxymoron pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. You just didn't really ever see it. And the reason why was that business travelers tended to be the ones booking last minute, and airlines knew this. And so they would jack up the price because they didn't care what the ticket cost. It was their company paying, not them. Nowadays, with business travel still down 50, 60% from where it was pre-pandemic, but leisure travel almost entirely recovered, airlines are realizing that they can't rely on those last-minute business travelers to book those seats. So instead, you're actually seeing far more last-minute cheap flights now than you had pre-pandemic. Do I think this is going to last for the rest of 2022? Probably not. I think it's going to start to revert to the mean as business travel recovers and as just travel demand in general picks up on the backside of the Omicron wave. But at least for right now, you're still seeing steals in last minute. I was looking for a last minute flight actually today to New York from my home in Portland, Oregon. And you could find flights for $98 each way, nonstop from New York City to Portland. And so those types of fares are just not what, I mean, that's a great deal anytime, but to see that on, you know, with a 1 day advanced notice purchase, you almost never see it. And so that's something that I think has been something of an anomaly during the pandemic that I would not expect to continue.
That's really amazing. What about future plans for Scott's Cheap Flights? Is there anything that you could talk about, new services, things that you're adding?
Sure. Yeah. Look, way that we have been operating at Scott's Cheap Flights is trying to increasingly personalize our service. So, you know, look, everybody wants cheap flights to Paris. Everybody wants cheap flights to Hawaii, to Japan. But what if you're somebody who has family in Uganda? What if you're somebody who took a honeymoon decades ago in Paraguay or somewhere that's maybe a little bit off the beaten path? Or what if you're a family who can only travel during the summer months or has to travel around the academic calendar? Right now, I'd say, frankly, we're certainly finding a lot of deals. We have tons of family members and tons of folks with family in Uganda that have been able to take advantage. But I think we could be doing a lot better job at being able to service everybody's individual, personalized, specific travel desires. Right now, we really focus on those opportunistic deals. We don't know when that, where that next great deal is going to pop up, but we want to try to do more to help folks. Hey, you've got that wedding coming up in Iceland. You've got no flexibility about where you go or when you go. How can we still help you get as good a deal as possible? And so that's kind of, without revealing too much about specific features or things we're building, that's the kind of goal that we have in mind, to try to be able to serve folks even better.
Something like that's just happened to me, where my nephew's getting married in Philadelphia in a few months, and I've been looking for airfare specifically around those dates. So your service would definitely be helpful for that as well.
Yeah, one of the biggest changes we made during the pandemic actually was, before June of 2020, we actually didn't even really send domestic flights. We focused almost exclusively on international. We did long-haul domestic, Hawaii and Alaska, but we figured we only want to focus on the deals that really save folks a ton of money, you know, like that $130 flight to Milan that we're saving $600, $700, $800 off normal prices. What changed was, A, most folks only wanted to travel domestically to the extent travel existed in 2020, and B, realizing that even for folks, when you're traveling domestically, even if you know you're not going to save that $550 off that, you know, you would with a normal like SkyTeam flights deal that we find to Europe or to Asia, you still want to get the best deal possible. When you're flying to Philadelphia, you still want to make sure you're not overpaying for your flight. And so realizing that was one of the reasons why we shifted and started to offer domestic support as well as international.
Yeah, and it certainly drives me crazy to find out that my seatmate paid $50 less for less than I did on my flight. Just drives me insane.
One of my favorite games to play when anytime I'm on a flight, start to ask people around me what if they paid to be on there, because it's fascinating to find out, and B, I think it's so eye opening for so many people to see how many different fares folks paid to be on this exact same place, sitting right next to one another. That's not something where there's a uniform price. There's not one specific price that it costs to fly from LA to New York or whatnot. It is the most volatile purchase that we regularly make. And so remembering that, and to be patient when flights are expensive, but be prudent and quick when flights are cheap, is how you have put yourself in a good position to not pay more than the guy sitting next to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably I just came back from Johannesburg, South Africa. So did a Los Angeles Johannesburg flight, and in business class paid $2,800, which I think was a pretty amazing fare.
Yeah, that would normally cost closer to $4,000 or $5,000. So well done.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was really happy with that. When I saw the fare, just jumped on it right away. And typically I don't fly in business class, but I just figured because of the fare itself, it was just worth pampering myself on that. So I felt pretty good about that one.
Oh, absolutely. Look, those long haul flights, you know, it can be tough to get a good deal in business class. And I think folks aren't always, aren't necessarily as aware of how much it typically costs to fly those transoceanic business class, you know, lie flat seats. It can be two or three times the price of economy. It can be 5 to 10 times the price of economy. And so all the more reason to make sure you're getting a good deal on those premium seats for long haul travel, because if you don't get a good deal, you can really end up breaking the bank paying for business class international seats.
Absolutely. And Scott, before I let you go, I have two quick questions for you here. One of them is, what's your most favorite aircraft to fly on?
Gosh, I like, you know, I'm a little bit of a wimp when it comes to turbulence. I'm going to be honest. Some folks might find that surprising. So the bigger the plane, the better. I love my A380. I love my 747. I find that they have far less turbulence in my mind than if I'm flying, you know, a 737, especially something like over the Rockies. Mm-hmm. Or I always tend to have really bad turbulence going to or from Hawaii. So give me those big planes. That's where I feel most comfortable.
Okay, so no 737s for you then.
Ideally, if I could have my druthers, it would be 777 or higher every time.
Okay. And then last question for you is there anything that I didn't ask that I should have?
Ooh, goodness. Where I think travel is headed in 2022, you know, one of the things that I love to do is make predictions and to really kind of hold myself accountable for what those predictions are. And so I made 17 predictions for 2022. I'm not going to go through all 17 of them because that'd take far more time than we have. But two of them that I'll go through right now, and again, we're recording this in mid-February, is that one, I think the domestic in-flight mask requirement will be repealed or be allowed to expire no later than June 30th. That is my prediction. Ooh. And the second one is that the negative test requirement to fly back to the US will also be repealed no later than the end of the summer, September 30th. I think that some of those kind of pandemic mandates, when it comes to air travel, the biggest differences will start to revert. And we're going to see a travel summer this year that looks much more like 2019 than the past couple of years have.
So then I'm assuming that you're going to predict that no airline will ever impose a vaccine mandate?
Not in the US. Absolutely not. I mean, and I think it's telling that any airline in the US is free to do that right now, mm-hmm. and none of them have done it. And that is in contrast to the mask mandate, where before it became a federal mandate in, I believe, January of 2021, basically all the entirety of the U.S. airline industry, in their own on their own volition, right, required masks on airplanes. And so I think the likelihood of a vaccine mandate to fly in the U.S. the likelihood is almost nil. Internationally, I know in Australia, there was some talk of it in Qantas. There's certainly still going to be quite a few places where you're going to have to be vaccinated to travel to, or at least to get around a mandatory mm-hmm. quarantine or some other stuff, essentially right. like the Easy Pass lane. That will start to, I would guess, diminish over the next few years. Again, it partly depends on the course of the pandemic, but I would say that the trajectory is pretty clearly going to be more towards a sense of normalcy than towards one of more restrictions going forward.
Yeah. And just my personal opinion on that is I think no airline was willing to do it for fear of losing business to the competition. It either everyone had to do it or mm-hmm. no one would do it. And with the mask, it being a federal requirement to wear a mask on the U.S. aircraft, it made it easy for every airline to go along with that, even though the airline started it before the government made it a requirement.
Yeah. And to be clear, I think you're actually going to still see masks pretty commonplace on airplanes for a mm-hmm. long time, especially in the wintertime, or especially during if there are other surges or waves coming in the future. I just think the mandate that they be there right. Is going to be something that's going to go away sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And I think the flight attendants will appreciate that. I was reading something the other day where so far this year, there were 357 incidents involving passengers, flight attendants, and masks. Just
not good.
Crazy.
Not good.
That's insane. All right, well, Scott, thank you so much for your time. Where could our listeners find more information about Scott's Cheap Flights?
Yeah, just go to our website, scottscheapflights.com. No apostrophes, no dashes or underscores, just scottscheapflights.com. It would be our honor to send you cheap flights out of your home airport.
Okay, Scott, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Scott is providing Airplane Geeks listeners with a membership discount. At checkout, enter the discount code GEEKS and receive 25% off a year of premium membership. Now, this offer is valid through April 30th, 2022. And we thank Scott's Cheap Flights for offering this discount to you. That's discount code GEEKS at scottscheapflights.com. Next, we have an Israeli news desk report from Eyal. Now, pretty soon, we're going to see if we can get him to record these himself. Meantime, here it is. An Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, spokesman released an announcement on March 1st, 2022, about a shootdown of two Iranian UAVs in June 2021. The two UAVs were carrying a load of pistols destined for Hamas in the Gaza Strip, sent from Iran. This was an attempt to find a new smuggling path from Iran to its proxies. Now, apart from the odd shipment, was the fact that the interception and shootdown had been made by an Israeli F-35A, named in Israel Eder, meaning mighty. This is the first operational and actual kill for the F-35 family worldwide. The IDF spokesman also points out that the UAV was tracked from an early phase of its flight, and the meetup between the UAV and the F-35 occurred outside the Israeli flight information region, and it was coordinated with other foreign nations. He says the press release probably came on the ground of the coming renewal of the nuclear agreement between the world powers and Iran in Vienna, and the efforts of Israel to show the world that the Iranians are pushing for instability in the Middle East. The short announcement reveals very few details and left some interesting questions unanswered, including what type of weapon was used. Probably an air-to-air missile, which means it was the first air-to-air combat launching from a stealth aircraft. Another question is about where it happened and who are the foreign countries that were made aware of the interception. Now, Eyal initially speculated that the intercept was made over the Mediterranean Sea or the Sinai Desert because he didn't think the Iranians could have tried to fly over Israel. However, in a subsequent update, Eyal says the UAV came from Iran. It is a copy of the U.S. Air Force UAV that was shot down a few years ago with autopilot and GPS. Also, the shootdown was made over Jordan. Finally, he says the shootdown joins other historical Israeli Air Force first shootdowns made by the Mirage 3, the F-16, and the F-15. All right. Thank you, Eyal. One last item. Listener Rob Coates noted that March 8, 2022 was the 8th anniversary of the loss of flight MH370, and he sends us his thoughts.
G'day, geeks. Rob Coates here from Perth, Western Australia. This is just a short message to mark yet another anniversary of what has, without a doubt, become the biggest mystery in aviation history. The disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. MH370, a 12-year-old Boeing 777, departed Kuala Lumpur International Airport, bound for Beijing in China, just after midnight on the 8th of March 2014. On board were 227 passengers and 12 crew. It was initially cleared to climb to 18,000 feet, and a short time later to 35,000 feet. 20 minutes after takeoff, the crew reported that they'd reached that altitude. 20 minutes after that, they were instructed to contact Ho Chi Minh ATC in Vietnam when they reached a certain waypoint. They acknowledged that instruction, and that was the last anyone has heard from MH370. The plane was observed on radar to turn west from the planned route, then make a turn to the northwest. Not long after, the aircraft's transponder signal was lost, and soon after that, it passed out of radar range. Eventually, the flight was reported as missing, and so began a huge international search. Records of signals sent between the aircraft and a communications satellite over the Indian Ocean revealed that the plane had continued flying, now heading south, for almost 6 hours after its final sighting on Malaysian military radar. The search concentrated on the southern Indian Ocean to the west of Australia. Aircraft and ships scoured a vast area for surface debris, and later submersibles were used to try to locate the black box pings, all to no avail. By October 2017, 20 pieces of debris believed to be from the aircraft had been recovered from beaches in the Western Indian Ocean. 18 of the items were, quote, identified as being very likely or almost certain to originate from MH370. These included a flaperon washed up on Reunion Island and an object bearing a stenciled label of No Step, found off the coast of Mozambique. Experts identified that as almost certainly a horizontal stabilizer panel from MH370. Now, 8 years after its disappearance, MH370 and the 239 souls on board are no closer to being found than they were when the official search was called off in January 2017. Numerous theories for its fate have been put forward. Murder-suicide by the plane's captain, a catastrophic fire on the flight deck that cut communications and prevented the flight crew from taking over control, and so on. My feeling is that one day, perhaps by chance, or more likely by advances in technology that we can't yet imagine, MH370's final resting place will be found. Hopefully that will reveal what really happened. Meanwhile, the relatives and loved ones of those 239 people are left wondering. This is Rob Coates in Perth, remembering MH370.
Thanks, Rob. I find it amazing that it's been 8 years since that plane was lost. All right, well, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guests this episode were Richard Thacker, the Director of Strategy and Operations at Atlantic Aviation. Find them at atlanticaviation.com. Also, Scott from Scott's Cheap Flights. In there, it's scottscheapflights.com. No punctuation, just Scott's Cheap Flights. And don't forget about the discount code GEEKS for the premium membership option, good through March 30th, 2022. Of course, a free level of membership is also available. Well, find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/695, and you can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you haven't subscribed, or as Apple now calls it, followed us, please consider doing so. You do that, and your podcast app will notify you when each episode is available. So please join us next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.